Okay, before we begin the shiur this evening, to mention a couple of things. Firstly, Baruch Hashem, the second volume of the Sefer Dimensions in Chumash, which is covering the Chumashim of Vayikra to Devarim, so that has been published. Looks like this. It should be available in all good Jewish bookstores. So that's that. And secondly, the Haggadah has been reprinted. That's the Darkness of Destiny Haggadah. That's also available. In addition to which, there will be, Mirtz Hashem, an evening for the Haggadah this week in the OU Center at Thursday evening at 7:30. So copies will be available there. All are welcome. And those are the housekeeping points for this evening. So from there, we get down to business and we enter the Chumash of Vayikra, known as Toras Kohanim, although I believe that for the next 2 weeks, we'll be devoting our discussions to Pesach-related matters. These will be the last two Mondays, the two Mondays before Pesach. But for the time being, we dip our feet into Toras Kohanim, Chumash Vayikra. And for the initial discussion, we note that Chumash Vayikra introduces us not only to the world of Korbanos, I mean, we've met Korbanos before, but we are in earnest. There is no avoiding it in Chumash Vayikra. It also actually introduces us to a phrase which will then be a recurring phrase throughout Chumash. And the first instance actually is in our Parsha, and that is in Pasuk Beis of Perek Aleph. So the Parsha and the Chumash, of course, begin, Vayikra el Moshe, Hashem calls Moshe, and says, Pasuk Beis, Daber el Bnei Yisrael v'amarta aleihem. Speak to Bnei Yisrael and say to them, Adam ki yakriv mikem, if one brings a korban, and then the rest is the unfolding and detailing of all the halachas of korbanos. Daber el Bnei Yisrael v'amarta aleihem. This is the first of many times that we will have this introductory expression. And it behooves us, therefore, in this opening instance, to ask the question, what is the connotation and the difference in meaning between Daber el Bnei Yisrael, speak to the people, Va'amarta Alehem, and say to them? What is the difference between those two phrases? Now, of course, on a very simple level, we understand that Dibur and Amira, just to translate the terms, do not relate to the same thing. Dibur is more the act of speaking. Dibur means speaking, and speaking is more the process of speaking. Amira is saying, which relates more to the content of what's being said. It's to illustrate this point, if one would report, you know, I spoke with so-and-so. And the follow-up question will be, and what did you say? What did they say? In other words, speaking represents the setting where there are words exchanged or transmitted. But saying is the actual content of what the message is. So they do have different connotations, but nevertheless, one could argue that the Pasuk could have just said, Emor el Bnei Yisrael, say the following to Bnei Yisrael. You can speak without saying, as we know all too well. But you cannot say without speaking. I mean, if you say something, that presupposes that you spoke, and therefore the fact that they are really separated into two terms, nonetheless, is something that deserves our attention. And one of the classic Mefarshim from the Acharonim, who discussed this point, what is Daber and what is Ve'amarta, is the Or HaChaim HaKadosh. And the Or HaChaim says that, in fact, these two phrases really, you could say, sum up the content and substance of what korbanos are. Because the truth is, korbanos come in two general forms. Some of them relate to wrongdoing, which means they have a harsher connotation, a more business-like connotation, one could say. One needs to deal with a problem. The korban is offered to deal with a problem. For example, a chatas, a sin offering to deal with sin. An asham, a guilt offering. So you have what you could call the more business end of korbanos. But then, on the other extreme, you have korbanos which are very positive. Shlomim is a peace offering. And there are certain korbanos which are celebratory in nature. It's korban chagiga and korban pesach. So it's very interesting that you have a spectrum, in a sense, of different moods and different situations that are being marked by the various korbanos. Some of them are harsher in nature. Some of them are more positive in nature. And what does this have to do with Dibur and Amira? Well, says the Ora Chaim, as we know, Rashi mentions this in a number of places in his commentary on the Chumash. The two terms Dibur and Amira differ in that Dibur is a Loshon Kosha. It has a harsh connotation. Like when Yosef spoke to the brothers, Vayidaber itam koshos. The Gemara says in Makkos, we see from here, Makkos Daf Yud, we got Aleph, that Dibur is a harsher expression. Amira is more pleasant. Amira Raka. And therefore, says the Ora Chaim, these two types of korbanos are introduced with Dabera B'nai Yisrael, the Amarta Alehem. There is the harsher introduction for those that are more related to negative situations like Chatos and Asham. And then there is the milder introduction for those that are more pleasant and positive in nature, like the Chagiga and the Shlomim and so on. So what's very interesting about this commenter of the Rachaim is that he has taken the two terms, Daber and Va'amarta, and really shown how they relate, they introduce specifically the world of Korbanos. Now, as we mentioned, this introductory phrase, Daber Va'amarta, will appear numerous other times in the Torah. According to the method of the Ora Chaim, we will need to see what is the Dibur element within that later topic and the Amira element within that later topic. And indeed, this is something that the Ora Chaim does in each of those occasions. He shows how there is a Dibur aspect to that topic being introduced and an Amira aspect. So this is the Ora Chaim on Daber Va'amarta. But earlier than the Ora Chaim, Rabbeinu Bachya, in his Perush on this Pasuk, already discusses the difference between Daber and Ve'amarta, and he gives what you could call a master key explanation. In other words, it is exactly the same for all such situations. And he explains that the difference in connotation is that Daber is more general in nature. Speak to them, in other words, let them know the idea generally. But as we know, Moshe transmits not only klolim, the general principles of the mitzvah, but also pratim, also the details. Details, says Rabbeinu Bachya, are indicated and denoted by the term amira. Amira is more specific to actually say the whole thing out. So once again, Daber is baklali, the more general presentation, and then Amira is bapratim. And the truth is, that might sound somewhat abstract. Rabbeinu Bachya immediately puts names to faces here to where will you find the general presentation? Where will you find the specifics? And the answer, says Rabbeinu Bachya, is as a matter of course, the general principles will be found in the psukim, but as we know, there's many details, and they are expounded and transmitted via the mechanisms of and principles of Torah Shebal Peh. In other words, if you wish to know the forum where you'll find Dibur, the general ideas, it will be in the reading of the verses. If you wish to know the arena where the particulars will be processed and expounded, that will be in the world of Torah Shebal Peh. And it turns out, therefore, that according to Rabbeinu Bachya, Daber is a watchword for Torah Shebichtav. And Va'amarta is a watchword for Torah Shebal Peh. And this is very interesting because it resonates most fascinatingly in a comment of the Vilna Gaon on two psukim in Tehillim. It's not often that we really get to grips with the psukim in Tehillim, but here's an opportunity in Perek Kuf Yud Tes, which is the longest Perek of Tehillim, as you may know. We will not start at the beginning. We're actually going to dip in right towards the end. There's eight verses for each letter of the Aleph Beis, giving a total of 176 psukim. And in the letter Shin, Shin and Sin. So there are two psukim. So the first is Sarim Ridafuni Chinam, nobles pursued me for naught. Umidvarcha pachad libi, and my heart feared your word. Sarim Ridafuni Chinam, umidvarcha pachad libi. Nobles pursued me over nothing, baselessly, but I was afraid of your word. The next verse, which I think is more well known, Sos anochi alimrasecha kemotzei shalal rav. I rejoice over your, again, words, like one who finds great treasure. So this is very interesting, because you have two verses, one after the other. And in the first verse, David HaMelech says, he was afraid of Hashem's dibur, umidvarcha pachad libi. And the very next verse says he rejoices over Hashem's Amira, Sos Anochi Alimrasecha. Why should the Dibur be cause for fear, and why should the Amira be cause for joy? Says the Vilna Gaon. There was an episode in David HaMelech's career when he killed Goliath, and as we know, Shaul had promised his daughter in marriage to the one who would slay the Goliath. And it ended up being David. So, Shiduchim. So Shaul begins to inquire, and he asks those around him, what is the lineage, the pedigree of David HaMelech? Is he worthy of marrying into the royal family? Now, one of Shaul's advisors, who was a very enigmatic person, his name was Doeg, and he was a great Talmud Chacham, but he also caused a great amount of trouble. He is on that infamous short list of people who are mentioned by name as not having a portion in Olam Haba. That Mishnah in the beginning of Perek Chelek, so called because it starts Kol Yisrael Yeshlem Chelek L'Olam Haba, which is a well-known quotation, the Mishnah proceeds to say Ve'ele She'ein Lehem Chelek L'Olam Haba. There are a number of exceptions, and Doeg is on that list. And Doeg was already causing trouble at that point. In response to Shaul's question, is David, does he have the yichus to marry into the royal family? Doeg says, you may wish to ask a prior question, your majesty. Can he even marry into the Jewish people? He's descended from Rus. Rus is from Moab. The Torah says, Le'avo amoni umo avi bekal Hashem. People from Moab can't even marry into the Jewish people, so we have a more basic issue at hand. Now, David had his defenders, and they start defense. Once the battle with Goliath ends, another battle ensues, a halachic battle, to defend the eligibility of David HaMelech to marry into the Jewish people. And some defend it by saying, well, the verse gives the reason why Moab can't marry into the Jewish people. Namely, they didn't come out to greet you with bread and with water when you came out from Egypt. So it's the way of men to come out, not the way of women. So David is descended from Rus. His Moabite roots are with Rus, on the mother's side, not on the father's side. And maybe the ban doesn't extend to females. Doeg wasn't having it. Doeg says, no, the men could have come out for the men. The women should have come out for the women. On the contrary, that would have been perfectly acceptable. The Moabite Ladies Guild, they could have made a kiddush for the women. And if they didn't, they are equally at fault. And the matter was at a standstill. And David's future was at stake to marry into the Jewish people. Until someone ran Amasa, I believe it was, ran to the Beis Din and brought back a report. And the report is kosher. Kach mekublani. We have a tradition in the Beis Din, from the Beis Din of Shmuel Haramasi, and mekublani means an oral tradition. Moavi velo moavis. The ban is for the males, not for the females. Regardless of expositions of the verses, regardless of interpretations and arguments and counter-arguments, it is a pure oral tradition that only the males from Moab are excluded, not the females. Well, says the Vilna Gaon, now we understand. Sarim Rdafuni Chinam. Nobles were pursuing me. Who are those nobles? They are the ilk of Doeg. Doeg the noble, the member of the Sanhedrin, the head of the Sanhedrin at one stage, I believe he was. And he's pursuing me to bar me from ever entering to the Jewish people. And what's more, says David, umidvarcha pachad libi. And in fact, from devarcha, which we now know means Torah shebichtav, I was afraid. It wasn't looking good for me in terms of Torah shebichtav, because there's no reason to distinguish between the males and the females, and it's hard to present an argument that can't be rebuffed. That was the situation, until along came Torah shebal peh. That's Amira. Sasa nochi al imra secha kamotzei shal rav. Rejoice over the Amira, the oral tradition of Torah shebal peh, that the males are barred but the females are accepted. So that's a real education as to how to take a look at Chumash at Sefer Tehillim. If I may just add a PS here, I think this may explain to us something else. There is a famous question. In fact, it's so famous people don't even know who originally asked it, because it's known as Tosus's question. When we came to receive the Torah, the Pasuk, as we know, says, Vayisyatzvu betachtisahar, that the mountain was suspended over the Jewish people. They were made an offer they couldn't refuse. Hashem said, if you receive the Torah, well and good, otherwise it will end here. And so, of course, we said yes. Tosfos asked the question. The Pasuk says, Naaseh v'nishma. The Pasuk says that when we were offered the Torah, even beforehand, we'd already said yes. If we'd said no, okay, it's regrettable, but there's room for coercion. But what is the meaning of coercing people who have already agreed? And that is the famous Tosfos question. Again, it's so famous, it's not so well known that it preceded the Tosfos. It's asked by the Medrash Tanchuma in Parshas Noach. And the Medrash answers, very interestingly, that when we said Naaseh v'nishma, and we had to be forced to receive the Torah, they're not for the same parts of Torah. The willing acceptance was for Torah shebichtav. Torah shebichtav is relatively easy to abide by. But we weren't so up for Torah shebal peh. When it says Vayisyatvu betachtis sahar, Hashem said, it's a package deal. You cannot have one without the other. And that is the resolution of the Medrash Tanchuma. Again, the initial Naaseh v'nishma related specifically to the written Torah, Torah shebichtav. The element that needed to be added through coercion was Torah shebal peh. Thus far, the Medrash Tanchuma. What does this have to do with us? If you look in Chumash Shemos, you will see that when Moshe puts Hashem, offers the Torah to Bnei Yisrael, they say, Vayan ha'am vayomar, kol asher diber Hashem na'aseh v'nishma. Everything that Hashem spoke, we will say and we will do. According to Rabbeinu Bachya, dibur relates specifically to the area of Torah shebichtav. And therefore, that really, I think, is a support for what we're saying here. They never said kol asher amar Hashem. That's not so simple. For that, you needed a bit of mountain work. But their initial willing acceptance was kol asher diber Hashem, which Rabbeinu Bachya has informed us is Torah shebichtav. So having involved ourselves in a bit of the Lashon HaKodesh aspects, Dibur and Amira, but as we can appreciate, these are tools for the rest of Chumash. These are principles, things to keep an eye out for the parshas to come. But let us get turn our attention to aspects of the Korbanos themselves. And I'd like to take a look at Pasuk Yud Aleph. Now, Perek Aleph is about Korban Ola. Okay, what's known as the burnt offering, that means to say the entire thing goes on the Mizbeach. There's more than one type of species that can be bought for as an Ola. In fact, the opening verses, the opening nine verses are about Min HaBakar, right, from cattle. And then from Pasuk Yud, we move to Min HaTzon. V'im HaTzon, Korbano, if it's from the Tzon, which is either sheep or goats, can also be bought as an Ola. Pasuk Yud Aleph, and I think this pasuk is quite well known. Some people say it regularly after the recitation of the Parsha of Tomid, of the daily offering. Pasuk Yud Aleph reads of Perek Aleph, V'shachat oso ayerech ha-mizbeach, tzafon alefnei Hashem. So he shall shecht it on to the north side of the mizbeach, and so on and so forth. V'zarko, and then the kohanim shall sprinkle the blood. But what's being emphasized here is that the place where the animal is shechted, which is the first stage of the avoda of Korbanos, is the north side specifically, right? We know the Mizbeach is surrounded, right, on every direction with the courtyard, but it's specifically on the north side. Okay. What's very interesting is, as we noted, this is not the first Korban to be mentioned in our Parsha, not the first type of Korban, it's the second. Okay, the opening verses were about what if a cattle is used, a par or whatever it will be. And sown from the flock, sheep and goats, are the second category. And it is only with regards to the second category that the Torah states, specifies the location, that it should be at the north side. What are we to make of this? Does that mean that it's only if it's from the flock, sheep and goats, that they are shechted on the north side? It's not true. So too, any Ola. And in fact, any Korban, which is in the category of what we call Kodshe Kodoshim, which is the holier, so to speak, segment of Korbanos, Kodshe Kodoshim, right? For those who are familiar with the Mishnayos of Ezu Mekoman, that's the refrain. Everything that's in the category of Kodshe Kodshim, Shechitas HaBatzafon, the Shechitas in the north, that's the, dare I say it, par for the course. But it's true for all Kodshe Kodoshim. And that being the case, we ask, why did the Torah not mention this at the first available opportunity, namely with the Bakar, rather waiting until we talk about the second, which means we then need to start expounding on the verses to show how it relates to every type of korban that's in Kodshe Kodoshim. Why pass over the first available opportunity? And the Meshech Chochmah has an answer to this question, which is absolutely stunning. And he says that the Medrash Vayikra Rabbah gives us a bit of insight as to the significance of the north side. It's very interesting. We're not familiar so much with the north side of anything as being of religious significance. As far as the Beis HaMikdash is concerned, the more west you go, the holier things get. For our part, we turn east. That's just because we generally tend to be towards the west, but the north side as a going concern is not something that we really have that much experience with. What's it all about? Says the Medrash, the word Tzafon, north, is very closely connected with the word Tzafun, that which is hidden away. So, says the Medrash, when you bring a korban, I recall the merit of Yitzchak, whose ashes are stored away with me, Tzafun. And that's why the highest level of korbanos are offered at the north side, Tzafon, in order to activate the memory, so to speak, of the ashes of Yitzhak, which are Tzafon. Of course, when we say the ashes of Yitzhak, we mean the ashes of Elo Shel Avraham, of the ram that was offered in Yitzhak's stead, which is this outstanding merit. Says Meshech Chachma, once we understand that the significant, the shall we say, the primary significance, and this is an amazing concept in Parshanut, the main reason, shall we say, why the north side is so significant is because Tzafon relates to Tzafon, the korban that was offered in Yitzchak's stead. And what was that korban? It was a ram. A ram is min hatzon. A ram comes from the flock. And therefore, as true as it is halachically, that even the earlier stated korban is also shechted at the north side, that is true, but that's an expansion of the concept at whose epicenter lies the ram of Yitzhak. And therefore, the Torah waits until we meet the species of animal that actually is the one for whose benefit the entire concept of the Tzafon is there, and that's where it mentions it's worth the wait. That is Meshech Chachma's Chiddush. And really what he's saying is, sometimes the reason why the Torah will forego an earlier opportunity to mention something is because there is something more of the essence in mentioning it later on. It's more impactful, it has greater associations, as we see here. Tzafon starts with Tzon, and that's why it's mentioned, specifically the second category of Tzon. Meshech Chachma goes further. As we know, just when we're ready to wind up, Meshech Chachma is just beginning. And he says, this will explain to us a very interesting moment in a discussion in the Gemara. Let's cue ourselves in so that we're as clear as can be. As we know, some korbanos come from animals, others come from birds. What about birds? Do they also need to be shechted on the north side? And the Gemara assumes, argues, maybe they should be. After all, what's the difference? There are even some requirements for korbanos of birds that are not needed for animals. So perhaps then maybe even make a kal vachomer, all the more so if you need the north side for animals, you should need for birds. But the Gemara disrupts that equation by saying what? No. Because consider, birds don't need to be shechted using a kli, using a utensil. As we know, the shechting of the bird happens through the nail, the thumbnail of the kohen. Animal needs a knife. Birds don't need a knife. So just like they don't need a knife, so maybe they don't need to be on the north side. Says Meshech Chachma, will someone please explain to me what a knife has got to do with the north side? Is there any connection? Or is it very simply, well, we see that they don't need A, so maybe they don't need B. Is there any connection between A and B? Says Meshech Chachma, indeed there is. Animals, when they're brought as korbanos, specifically need to be shechted using a kli, using a knife. Where does that come from? How do we know? Could use a blade of grass if it was sharp enough, etc. No, it needs specifically to be a kli. Where does that requirement come from? Says the Gemara in Maseches Zvachim, Daf Tzadik Zayin, Amud Beis. We learn it from the Akedah. In the same way that the Pasuk makes mention and emphasizes, or specifies it more correctly, that one of the things that Avram took was the ma'acheles, right, which is the knife. In the same way that he used the knife, we learn, it's very interesting that we learn halachas of korbanos from the Akedah. And that's where it comes from. So says Meshech Chachma, now we can understand on a much deeper level why the Gemara says, well, if a bird doesn't need a knife, then maybe it doesn't need the north side. It's not just saying, well, if it doesn't need that, maybe it doesn't need this. But rather what it's saying is, if a bird doesn't need a knife, and we derive the requirement of a knife from the Akedah, so apparently the category of korbanos of birds has nothing to do with the Akedah. Well, if that's true, then for that exact reason, it shouldn't need the north side, because the north side comes from the Akedah also, because Tzofon is from Tzofon, which is the ashes of Avram's ram. So it's a completely different appreciation of the undercurrent of how the Gemara is associating lack of requirement for knife, learned from the Akedah, with lack of requirement for north from the Akedah. And with that, we're almost done, because there is a finale here in Meshech Chochma. It's just how all of the worlds of Halacha and Medrash and Parshanut, they're Belila Achas, they're just one blended entity. The Pasuk says, which we quoted, V'shachat Oso, Pasuk Yud Aleph, he shall shecht it on the north side. Whenever we have an emphasis, like the word it, the implication is this, but not something else. What is excluded through the specifying of Oso? Well, the answer, I think, is impossible to guess, so let's get down to it. The Gemara in Maseches Menachos, Daf Nun Hey, says that the word Oso emphasizes this needs the north side, as opposed to, you know which Korban did not need the north side? The Chatas of Nachshon ben Aminadav. What's the placing of that chatos? What is that? That's the Nesiim. For the first 12 days of the operation of the Mishkan, every day, as we know from Chanukah, and as we know, it's the end of Parshas Noso. Well, it's the second half of Parshas Noso. All the korbanos of the Nesiim. The first one to go was Nachshon ben Aminadav. Vayihi hamakriv bayom harishon. Nachshon ben Aminadav. Lematei Yehuda. Says the Gemara, that's what's being excluded from the emphasis of Oso. This needs to be on the north side. Nachshon's Chatos didn't need to be on the north side. Says Meshech Chochma, will someone please tell me how Nachshon's offering on that occasion somehow caught the inference that this yes, Nachshon's offering no. Says Meshech Chochma, by this stage it should be quite clear why the Gemara draws a line. That line in the way that it does. What is the inception, or more correctly, the association of the north side, the significance of the north side, is that it recalls the merit of the Akedah. And why is that such an outstanding merit? Because it was an act of Mesiras Nefesh on Yitzchak's part. He is prepared to give up his life. And we wish to recall that as a merit for us. Everyone needs it, except for Nachshon. Because as we know, when we came to the banks of the Red Sea and no one's moving, it's Nachshon that jumps in. And he doesn't know what's going to happen. But Moshe says, go, and he goes. Nachshon doesn't need to recall the merit of someone else's act of offering up his life, because he had himself done that in his own experience, with his own actions. And therefore, says Meshech Chochma, we now understand why the one exception to this Kodshei Kadoshim rule that it needs to be on the north was Nachshon ben Aminadav. He was self-made. And that is the explanation of the Gemara. So once again, it's to see how one can only really stand and look and behold the Meshech Chochma as he goes through all of Shas and all of Torah and shows you how, in a sense, the inner workings of the associations that are being made. So these are his comments with regards to Pasuk Yud Aleph, the shechting at the north side. From this detail in Korbanos, let us move perhaps to a more general discussion. As we know, since time immemorial, certainly from the days of the Rishonim, less so actually in the time of Chazal, it's very interesting. The major question as to what are korbanos all about? What is the meaning of bringing a korban? It's not really discussed so much in the Gemara. But Rishonim, of course, discussed it at great length. Rambam, famously, Ramban and others, as we have presented in the past. But there is still room to ponder further what is bringing a korban all about. And the question, one could say, is compounded, because we seem to get a bit of a mixed message from the Torah itself about korbanos. Certainly from the Nevi'im, by which I mean, on the one hand, however you understand it, or whether you understand it or not, korbanos clearly are in the Torah, and there's mitzvahs, and they're good, however they work. But then, you have, once in a while, messages from the Nevi'im. And here's one from Yirmiyahu HaNavi. It's in Perek Zion. It's actually from the beginning of the Haftarah to Parshas Tzav. But although next week is Parshas Tzav, we won't be learning this Haftarah because next week is Shabbos HaGadol. So we'll take a couple of psukim here. Perek Zion, Pasuk, Kaf Beis. Says the Navi, Ko Amar Hashem, Ki lo dibarti es avoseichem, I did not speak to your ancestors, Velo tzivisim, and I did not command them, Biyom hotzi'i osam me'eretz Mitzrayim, on the day I took them out of Egypt, I didn't command them, Al divrei ola ozavach. I did not, you know, on that historic occasion, when I begin to give them mitzvahs, I didn't speak to them about korbanos. Of course, the Korban Pesach is what got us out of Mitzrayim in the first place. But once we're leaving and we have exposure to mitzvahs, Korbanos were not on that initial list. What did I speak to them about? Pasuk Kaf Gimel. Ki emes hadavar hazeh tzivisi osam le'emor. I commanded them the following. Shim'u b'koli, heed my voice. V'yisi lachem l'elokim, I'll be your God to you. V'atem to you l'la'am, you'll be my nation. V'alachtem b'kol aderech asher atzaveh eschem, and you shall go in all the path that I will command you. So here you have Yirmiyah, and he's really, in a sense, one could say, downplaying the role or the significance or the importance of korbanos. He says to the people, there was no mention of korbanos when you first came out. That wasn't a priority. I didn't talk about that. We spoke about other things. But what exactly is the abiding message then about the role of korbanos? We get a bit of a hot and cold feeling, because every celebratory occasion, the Chanukah, Beis HaMikdash, and so on and so forth, was accompanied by korbanos. There's no doubt that they're part of the program of mitzvahs. So what are we to make of all this? Among the classic approaches to the question of korbanos, an approach that I feel is very meaningful and reaches out, one could say, beyond the sphere of korbanos themselves, comes from the writings of the Maharal. The Maharal discusses this matter in a number of places, in his Sefer Nesivos Olam, and in his Sefer Gevuras Hashem, and in his commentary to Pirkei Avos, Derech Chaim. And Maharal says, korbanos come to address what is one of the primary concerns and perhaps primary pitfalls, potentially, of human existence. It is the nature of human existence in this world that a person sees himself as an independent existence, and perhaps even the primary existence, that the world revolves around him. He's not beholden to anyone, and he's not dependent on anyone for his existence. It's easy to be lulled into that, because we begin life through existing. But as you can appreciate, if a person doesn't realize where their existence comes from, it will have implications for everything they do. Because there isn't really anyone that can tell them what to do, and they don't feel beholden to anyone in terms of their moral obligations or life course or anything like that. What is a korban? Korban comes from the word karov, to bring a person close. It brings a person close to Hashem, because it nullifies the existence of something. Thankfully, we're not called upon to nullify our own existence, which would, of course, make the point quite compellingly, but leave us with less to do afterwards. But you take another being, and for this purpose, it's considered to be a very good cause, and you nullify its existence in order to impress upon yourself that all of existence is really secondary and dependent upon Hashem, who is the primary existence. That is what a korban is, and that brings you closer. Because if you don't see your existence as dependent and secondary to that of Hashem, you're distant. You're detached. You are the opposite of korban. You're the opposite of korov. And the results are accordingly. In fact, this, I think it really, it hits home. This understanding of korbanos. It will explain to us, apart from anything else, a rather curious thing. Namely, we have a notion that davening, that prayer, is like a korban. I mean, where do we see this? Where the Gemara says that the daily tefillahs corresponded to the sacrificial order. Shachris corresponds to the morning daily offering, mincha to the afternoon daily offering, ma'ariv to the various avodos that would pertain to the evening. So our davening parallels the offering of korbanos, and davening itself is something like a korban. But how? I mean, it's a good thing, it's a worthy thing, but it doesn't make it something else. But the more we understand that at the heart of a korban is a recognition, and for whose purpose we bring a korban, to recognize and maintain our consciousness and awareness that our existence is secondary, that is something that is also expressed through davening. Because if we pay attention to what we're saying, which hopefully we are, we're basically asking Hashem for everything. And the recognition that comes with that, that you ask because you need to ask, because that's where it comes from. It doesn't come from you. So in a sense, our own awareness of what we are and where our existence comes from and who is responsible for our needs, which was something that was achieved through the bringing of a korban, is achieved to a certain degree also by davening. And that's why when we end the Shemona Esrei, as we get in the closing stages more correctly, we ask Shema Koleinu, we ask Hashem to hear our prayer, and then we say Ritzei Hashem should be happy with our avoda, the Ishe Yisrael, and with the prayers of the fire offerings of the Jewish people. It's very interesting and something to think about, worth thinking about. We say it every day. We say, desire ba'amcha Yisrael b'sfilasam v'hasheves ha'avodola d'vir be'secha, and restore the avoda. And why are we asking Hashem to restore the avoda? Because we've gone as far as we can without korbanos. We've taken a fundamental step with the recognition that comes through davening, but now we ask that the korbanos themselves should come back. And when we say v'ishe Yisrael, there's a major question as to whether the words v'ishe Yisrael are connected to the first sentence, Hashavas Havoda Ledvir Beisecha V'Ishe Yisrael, period, meaning bring back the Avoda and bring back the Ishe Yisrael, the fire offerings. But I think it's more common that we end the sentence, Hashavas Havoda Ledvir Beisecha, bring back the Avoda to the Beis HaMikdash. And the new sentence begins, V'Ishe Yisrael Usfilasam Be'Avasaka Bavratza, and then accept our fire offerings and our tefillos. But what fire offerings? In the interim, you don't have them. Except we do. Because that's what the tefillah is. It's taking the place of a korban to the extent that it can. So that is a word on davening as korban, which I think is also a major statement, not only about korbanos, but also about prayer. What is it that a person is doing? It's a recognition. And we should appreciate also that the full implications of this recognition, of bringing a korban, should then be felt way beyond the confines and the environs of the Beis HaMikdash. Because if that recognition really sets in, it should affect everything that a person does. throughout this day, because it's all a function of this fundamental question: who is responsible for my existence? If I'm the primary existence, I'll decide, I can do what I want. If I'm a secondary existence, a dependent existence, well, maybe I need to check in with someone else, and it should affect the way that I do things, and maybe they have their wishes, and for good reason. So in a sense, the fullest appreciation of what a korban is that it's only the beginning. It's the beginning of something that really doesn't end, but it continues as the person leaves the Beis HaMikdash. And indeed, according to Rabbi Eliezer Ashkenazi, one of the great early Acharonim, in his classic Pirush Maaseh Hashem to the Torah, this is the meaning of the recurring phrase that we have throughout the sections of Karbonos, Reach Nichoach. Reach Nichoach, which literally means a pleasing aroma. And what does that mean? In more helpfully, what does that mean more practically? Says the Maaseh Hashem, what is an aroma? An aroma is a sense of something before it's arrived. Right? When you can smell whatever it is, the food cooking, you have a sense of something to come, even though it's not there yet, it's not in front of you yet. Says the Maaseh Hashem, that is exactly what a korban is. A successful korban is an aroma of things to come. As if to say, you've registered with this recognition, so deliver. Deliver the goods, deliver the cooked foods. Let's see how it expresses itself now in our behavior beyond the Beis HaMikdash. And with this in mind, we come back to the way that the Nevi'im talk about korbanos, sometimes extolling them, sometimes downplaying them. What's the key here? But rather, the point is that it depends how are the people doing in other areas of Jewish life. Because if the only thing they're doing is bringing korbanos, and they're remiss in every other area, so in a sense, they're missing the point. And then korbanos have fundamentally lost a lot of their value. And that's why Yirmiyahu says, if you're only bringing korbanos, but you're not really doing anything else, don't forget, I didn't speak to you about korbanos first when I took you out of Mitzrayim. I spoke about other things because a korban is meant to get you there. You're not meant to stop after the korban. It's really, that's what's meant to get you started. And what the prophets are decrying is a situation where people are bringing korbanos, but their behavior does not, you'd never tell that this person brought a korban from the minute he steps out of the Beis HaMikdash. He's back again, oppressing whoever he's oppressing, cheating whoever he's cheating, doing whatever he's doing, and you couldn't know. You couldn't know that he just had a visit to the Beis HaMikdash. He's an organized person. He brought his korbanos, and then he gets on with the rest of his day. Never the twain shall meet. And in that respect, say the Nevi'im, the person has missed the point, and the korban has missed the mark. Not only is it possible for someone to continue acting wrongfully in spite of the fact that they bring a korban, it's actually possible for a person to act wrongfully because they brought a korban, on account, as a result of the fact that they brought a korban. How so? One of the very first messages that we hear in the beginning of the parsha is a korban is disqualified if it's stolen. Where does that come from? There's actually more than one source, but the famous one is Rashi in the beginning of Parshas Vayikra. Why? Because in Pasuk Beis, Perek Aleph Pasuk Beis, it reads, Daber al Bnei Yisrael v'amatar lehem, as we discussed at quite some length, speak to the Jewish people, say to them, Adam, a person, ki yakriv mikem korban Hashem. The Torah normally uses the expression ish, or maybe no expression at all. But Adam has an interesting connotation, and Rashi himself notes this and says that the message is, you've got to be like Adam. When Adam brought a korban, it wasn't stolen. How do we know that? Because there was no one to steal from. So that's what it should be like. You can't bring a stolen animal as a korban. Why can't you bring a stolen animal as a korban? Well, that would seem to be one of the simplest questions to answer, because it's stolen. Look at where it came from. It came from wrongdoing. It's not acceptable. Says the Kli Yakar, that's a good answer, but it's half of the answer. Because the full answer why a stolen animal is disqualified and considered an abomination as a korban is not only in recognition of where it came from, but also in recognition of what it will lead to. Because you can now envisage a situation where a person who likes to steal, except they don't like to be in the red when it comes to these matters, which is perhaps an inadvisable expression with regards to korbanos, but what do? They offer a korban once in a while. In other words, the bringing of a korban is in order to make things right, and now that things are right, they can proceed to steal again. In other words, the bringing of the korban begets further wrongdoing. It's like an inbuilt program of expiation, which then leads to the perpetuation of the very wrongdoing. So not only is this stolen animal a result of stealing, it's also a trigger for more stealing, because we're all clear. So my slate is clear, off I go again to steal some more. And that is, that whole thing is a complete misuse, if not abuse, of korbanos. And that's what the Nevi'im are talking about. And thus you find, and probably the greatest expression of someone decrying korbanos when everything else is going so terribly wrong, that is to say, what the people are doing, is Yeshaya. It's Chazon Yeshayahu. It's the first chapter, which we read on Shabbos Chazon. That's why it's called, right, the Shabbos before Tisha B'Av. And he basically describes every form, certainly, of social wrongdoing, of societal wrongdoing, of oppression of the poor, taking advantage of the weak, and so on and so forth. And you're bringing korbanos. And what does Yeshaya says? He says, lo chafatzti, savati, I've had enough. Enough korbanos already. I'm not interested. What a thing to say. He's not interested. But why is he not interested? Because the very same person who's bringing a korban is currently oppressing whoever, and he's not going to stop. And the korban might just make him feel better about doing the wrong thing. So Yeshaya says, enough with the korbanos. And he also says, and enough with the prayer. And we understand, I think, now why. Because prayer also isn't working. The Jewish people, Hashem always gets the message, but the person who's praying doesn't get the message, because here he is, he's praying, showing his dependence on Hashem, but he'll do whatever he wants anyway. So he hasn't gotten his own message, and that's why Yeshaya says, "Uve farizchem kapechem," when you raise up your hands, "Alim eini mekem gam ki tarbu tefila ineni shomer," you can keep on davening. I'm not going to listen. It's not a punishment per se, but in other words, your tefillah isn't working because you aren't paying attention to what you're saying. If you did, you'd stop oppressing the poor. But the very same Yeshaya, who so castigates the people for offering korbanos while they are doing the wrong thing, is the one more than anyone else who shows how korbanos ultimately will be restored. When the message is reclaimed, korbanos will be restored. Because it's Yeshaya who says, in that vision of the future, Vavio Simal HaKadshi, which we say this during the Slichas and the Haftarah for Tanis Tzibor, Vavio Simal HaKadshi, I'll bring them to my holy mountain, V'simachtim V'veis Tefillah, see, and gladden them in the house of my Tefillah, which is interesting because the Beis HaMikdash is also in the future referred to as a house of tefillah. But of course, for our purposes, more than anything else, Olo Seichem v'zivcheichem l'ratzona mizbechi. All of your korbanos, right, the olos and the zvachim, l'ratzona mizbechi. They will be accepted with favor. Why? Because when the Jewish people finally see how korbanos are at the center of godly living, which extends to everything they do. So when they get that, the korbanos, which were the subject, were an anathema at the time leading up to the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, will be once again pleasing as Hashem describes for the Jewish people in the time of the redemption. So these, I think, are on the one hand important comments with regards to korbanos as korbanos, and we always try and get a deeper connection, a deeper appreciation of what korbanos are as we go through the parshas. But as we said, the more we ponder this central principle of the Maharal, the more that we see that we have the same dynamic even now in the form of tefillah. And just like korbanos, tefillah is also measured by the way that a person really takes their own message from the tefillah in terms of the things they do. Rav Kook is famous for saying, because the Gemara says, in the fifth parak of Maseches Brachos, that a shul needs to have windows. It's learned from the Beis HaMikdash. Chalomot shkufim adumim, it's in Melachim Aleph Perek Ches, when it describes the Beis HaMikdash. The Beis HaMikdash had windows, and the shul is like a Mikdash Ma'at, and the shul needs to have windows. It's an interesting thing to take into consideration, especially many of the shuls begin in someone's miklat, their bomb shelter. It's a little bit hard to find windows there. A lot of congregations really begin as underground movements. I think that's probably the most apt way to refer to them. But as we rise above ground level, it's important that the shul should have windows. And why should the shul have windows? Why does the Beis HaMikdash have windows? It says Rav Kook in his Chiddushi Agodas Ein Ayah, because there has to be some type of visual contact between inside the shul and outside the shul. If there's no windows, so then once again, the two never meet. Inside he's davening, outside whatever, and there's no, you can't see the world outside from the shul. You shouldn't spend your time davening looking outside the window. That's true, but the world outside should have some point of contact with what's happening, because the feature and almost like the characteristic of a successful time in shul through that window is how life looks once a person leaves. So these, I think, are certainly worthy sentiments, and the more we take them to heart, the more we can ourselves look forward to the time of Avi Yosimala Kochi, Simachtim Beveis Filasi, Olusehem Vizivachem, Leratzono Mizbechi, with a final Geula which should come be Mehir. All the very best, and wishing you a wonderful weekend.